Tom Hartman is excellent. He's bright. He's personable.
Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome to the Free Speech Zone.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. Our phone number, 866-303-2270, tomhartman.com. If you want to drop into our live chat room, I believe that there's also a link off of, and if not, there will soon be, airamerica.com. Where there's also a blog for our program. A lot in the news today. The war on terror isn't doing so well for the Bush administration, but the war on Nancy Pelosi seems to be moving along. The attacks from the right-wing blogosphere. But this is nothing compared to the attacks from Orrin Hatch and Rush Limbaugh against Carol Lam, the purged U.S. attorney, the fired U.S. attorney. Limbaugh on his program, Orrin Hatch saying, you know, she's a former law professor, no prosecution experience, a former campaign manager in Southern California for Clinton. Sorry, all wrong. She was a prosecutor for 15 years. She was never a law professor. She never worked for the Clinton campaign. I mean, it's the politics of personal destruction elevated to an art form, particularly when they go after women. And so now here, you know, Carol Lam, Nancy Pelosi, Hillary Clinton, the list just goes on and on and on. So we'll see how this all shakes out. In the meantime, hundreds are protesting Cheney's visit at Brigham Young University here in Salt Lake City. There's only 11% of voters, Provo, Utah, only 11% of the voters in Provo voted for John Kerry. But people showed up to say no to Dick Cheney, just like the day before they were showing up to say no to Karl Rove. That's interesting that young folks are starting to get stirred up. Meanwhile, in the information disinformation wars ongoing, the White House unveiled a public internet database, lists all the pet spending projects lawmakers tucked into the federal budget for the last fiscal year, 2004-2005. However, they did not include the earmarks that the president and his administration requested. This is like, look at their park, but not at our park. It's becoming tragic. So anyhow, there's a lot of stuff going on, you know, broadly speaking, in the news. Alberto Gonzalez is hunkered down. He's going to spend the next couple of days drawing a salary from you and me while he's being coached by Ed Gillespie, former RNC chairman, in how to testify before Congress without going to jail. They're rehearsing him the same way that John Roberts rehearsed the attorneys who then argued before the Supreme Court in 2000 in the Bush v. Gore case that they should stop the counting of the vote in Florida because it would cause irreparable harm to George W. Bush if they actually counted all the votes in Florida. Yes, that was the argument that was made before the Supreme Court, and that's what the Supreme Court ruled in Bush v. Gore, is that irreparable harm would occur, would be conferred upon George W. Bush, the plaintiff, in the case against Al Gore, if the vote was counted in Florida. Oddly enough, I mean, you know, so anyhow, just the same way that John Roberts, who was rewarded for his work with the Chief Justiceship of the Supreme Court, same way that he was teaching attorneys how to argue like this in front of Mr. Rehnquist, for whom he was formerly a clerk, same way that that's happening. Now you've got Ed Gillespie coaching Alberto Gonzalez. But in the midst of all this, oil prices are going up. And I get this email. And I remember the first time I got one of these, it was probably 4 years ago. We've been doing this program for 4 years last month. So we're 4 years a month. And it was right after I had started doing the program. So probably about 4 years ago. It was pretty much an identical thing. And every year it seems to be revived, particularly in the springtime for some reason. I think it's, you know, leading up to the summer driving season. This one, and I get a whole bunch of these, right? And probably because I'm a fairly public profile, but I'm guessing that you may have gotten one as well. This is just one of these kind of internet, you know, vanishing hitchhiker stories, spam across the web. Everybody gets them. This one comes from Well, I'm not going to, you know, name who sent it. It's just, you know, presumably a listener, somebody I don't know. But it arrives as, I've sent a copy of this to the Associated Press as a press release. I'd like to get this notice out as quickly as possible across the Internet. Can you send it to everyone on the list? Encourage them to do the same. I need churches and pastors to receive it as well. Anyone and anybody on MySpace, any other way you can think of to get this message out to as many people. And people, you know, of good conscience and goodwill are promoting this message. And here's the message. They give a particular date in May, and they say on that date, Americans around the country are going to be observing what's now called the National Day of Rest. Americans are binding together and agreeing to park their cars from midnight until midnight for one day, and also not to fly or operate gas-powered engines. The goal is for billions of barrels of crude oil to stockpile around the world, forcing gas prices downward. This National Day of Rest. This National Day of Rest is in response to higher gas prices and the threat of gasoline being more than $3 a gallon by the start of summer. I'm sorry. The first time I got one of these things, it was from somebody who's an old friend, and I just fired back an email without even frankly thinking about it a whole lot, which was a little sarcastic, like, give me a break. We're all going to stop driving for one day. And that's going to cause ExxonMobil to reduce the price of gasoline? That's like a heroin addict saying, you know, I think I'll stop using heroin for 6 hours or 10 hours or for a day. And think that it's going to influence the price of heroin. It ain't. It's not going to do anything at all. The tragedy is that people get sucked up into this thing and they go, oh, yeah, if I stop driving for a day, if we have a national boycott, That'll show those oil companies. No, it'll show them absolutely nothing, frankly. I mean, that's what it comes down to. What we need in this country is to stop being addicted to oil. This is just the absolute fundamental bottom line. And you don't stop an addiction by having a one-day boycott in order to drive down the price so you can have more of the product to which you're addicted to at a lower cost. You get the fundamental lack of logic here? We're facing a really serious problem worldwide, in the United States and around the world. In the front page of today's Wall Street Journal, Mexico tries to save a big fading oil field. This is the Cantarell oil field, the largest that Mexico has. They say the subhead, this is David Lunau's article in today's Wall Street Journal, Cantarell's drop off faster than expected, turning to technology. Cantarell, this is the oil field in Mexico, produces one in every 50 barrels of oil in the world. And quoting from today's Wall Street Journal, it is fading so fast, analysts believe Mexico may become an oil importer in 8 years. That would batter Mexico's economy, which depends on oil exports to fund 40% of its governmental spending. Now, just consider this for a minute. The United States was an oil exporter up until the early 1970s. That's when we hit peak oil. Sometime between 71 and 74, we hit peak oil. That is the point where 50% of all the oil is gone, and the last 50% is a whole awful lot more expensive and harder to get out of the ground than the first 50%. We hit peak oil, and we went from being a net oil exporter, which we had been from the late 1800s, right through the 1970s. We went from being a net oil exporter to being a net oil importer. And there was a rather substantial shock to our economy that came about as a consequence of that lasted, you know, through the tail end of the Nixon administration, the Ford administration, and the Carter administration. And I would say is, you know, still echoing to this day. Not to mention the international shocks. Back in 1996, I wrote a book called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, and which was published in 1997 by Random House. It's still out there in print. We updated it about 2 years ago. And, in fact, Leonardo DiCaprio made a 10-minute web movie inspired by the book, and he gives us a very kind credit for it. You can see it at his website, leonardodicaprio.com or leonardodicaprio.org. It's called Global Warning. And in that book, back in 1996, I wrote, peak oil is coming to the world, and we can expect to see resource wars over oil by 2002. That was like 6 years out into the future. And sure enough, we invaded Iraq in 2003. So imagine what is going to happen with Mexico. 40% of the entire budget of the government of Mexico, which was, you know, none of the budget of the United States government was coming from the export of oil in the early 70s and late 60s. Even though we were exporting oil, we had profits going to oil companies, but none of our budget was coming from that. 40% of their budget is coming from the export of oil, and they're going to start importing oil within 10 years. We're going to have a failed state on our southern border. 16 minutes past the hour.
Is the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio.
Demand is up, supplies are down. What I want is like crude and brown. I crave oil to get my kicks. Attacked Iraq to get my fix. I love oil, oh, every ounce. Nuclear, I can't pronounce. When my twins go out for fun, I say don't drive, take Air Force One. Oh, we can't conserve it, we are just way too spoiled. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we need oil.
Well, it's heating up, you know it's starting to boil. Gonna
and
face it. We're addicted to oil.
Indeed. And we are. Welcome back. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. This is really serious stuff. On the one hand, we have Al Gore running around the world and doing a marvelous job of it. I introduced him here in Portland and had frankly, the honor of spending some time talking with him and introducing him and moderating a question and answer session that he did with, I don't know, probably 6,000 people here in the basketball stadium, whatever you call those things, here in Portland in the Rose Garden. And doing a very good job of pointing out the negative consequences of the use of fossil fuels, which includes oil, although one of the other, you know, there's a bunch of major fossil fuels that are used out there, including coal. But peak oil is something that's frankly rarely discussed in the mainstream media. And it's on the front page of today's Wall Street Journal. And what they're pointing out, although they're not saying it, I'll give you the rest of the story, as it were, here. They come out and say Mexico, number one, 40% of the government's income for the nation of Mexico, 40% of it comes from the sale of oil. And their biggest oil field is collapsing. It's crashing. They're projecting the percentage of change over the next 3 years for the Cantarell oil field in Mexico at 30%. That's 10% a year. Now, they're also predicting, by the way, the percentage of decline for Saudi Arabia's largest oil field, the Ghawar oil field, at 10.7%. The Santrach-operated fields, including Hassi Massoud in Algeria at 13%, the Dajing field in China at 12% decline. These are decline rates. The Iranian Awa Asamri field at 14%. Well, basically, what we have is a bunch of oil fields around the world that are crashing, and they're crashing really fast. And the main reason why they crash really fast like this, as the Wall Street Journal talking about today, is these changes in the technology that's used to extract the oil from the ground in the first place. In the old days, when you just stuck a pipe down and sucked up the oil fields would start tailing off like they did in New Jersey and in Pennsylvania. Remember Standard Oil of New Jersey? Remember Standard Oil of Ohio? Well, you're probably not old enough. None of us are, because it was in the 1880s, but I think that they were pumping oil up until about the 1950s out of Ohio. I know they were pumping oil in Michigan up until the 1960s. So there was oil all across the eastern United States, Standard Oil in New Jersey. There used to be huge networks of oil tanks and oil, and they would suck the oil out. And the last, you know, then it would start to decline. Once they passed the peak, it would start dropping off 2-3% a year. Well, what they're doing now is they've got these new technologies where they inject nitrogen or they inject water or they inject steam, or they've got these cracking technologies or these horizontal drilling technologies where they shoot one thing down and then it goes out horizontally in a whole bunch of different directions. It's called scrubbing. It's like a scrub brush going out. And what it does is it cracks up all the ground around and it pulls all the oil out of a whole bunch of different fields all at once. And so when these fields go into decline, they go fast. And $60 a barrel oil is, in my opinion, nothing. We're going to be seeing, mark my words, within 2 years, oil at least at $100 a barrel and probably at $200 a barrel. And even more troublesome, even more worrying, Saudi Arabia is declining very, very rapidly. As I pointed out in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight, they increased by about a third how much oil they said they had when the World Bank said, well, you can start borrowing oil or borrowing money based on how much oil you have. Virtually all of the OPEC nations suddenly had a third more oil than they did the day before, and there was no new discoveries. They simply said, hey, we got more oil. Hey, give us some money. So what's going to happen to Mexico when 40% of the government's budget goes away? What's going to happen to Mexico when they have to start importing oil instead of exporting it? And by the way, this is just, you know, one dimension of all these many problems. Leonardo DiCaprio has a new movie coming out. He's on the cover of Vanity Fair this month. Annie Leibovitz shot a great photo of him on an iceberg in southeast Iceland, a glacier, excuse me. It's called The 11th Hour. I'm in it, so I'm shameless plug here, but it's a great movie. And it's going to be a great movie. It's going to be coming out this summer. They're going to roll it out at Cannes, and it's on the cover of Vanity Fair this month, just as a heads up. But there's this whole large, and in the meantime, we've got people running around saying the solution to this is that we should all boycott gasoline for 24 hours, and that'll drag down the price of oil. I'm telling you, we are facing resource wars. We're facing a failed state to our south. We're facing an implosion of the Saudi government and several other relatively stable Sunni governments in the Mideast, and some of the Shia governments as well, like Syria and Iran. Iran, particularly. Iran, it says they're building nuclear power plants because their oil fields are in decline. And they are! So what are we going to do? Time for alternative energy. Time for solar power. Time for wind power. Power. Time for a Manhattan Project to do this. And maybe you have some ideas on this. Take your calls in just a minute. 27 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. Thousands of sick and dying patients find marijuana effective as a medicine, including cancer, MS, and AIDS patients. 9 states have legalized its use. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
The Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Four minutes past the hour and the place where smart people get their news. The Tom Hartman Program here on Air America Radio. While we're all looking at things like, you know, the relatively minor drama, I realize it's a big deal. It seems like a big deal right now of you know, Daryl Issa, for example, is the Republican congressman from California who arguably provoked the whole gubernatorial crisis, that spasm that California went through with his, you know, $1 million to try and take out Gray Davis. Daryl Issa, and then, you know, and then sobbing when Schwarzenegger decides to run. Nonetheless, he's in Damascus right now, along with two others. He's a bunch of Republicans in Damascus right now talking to Assad. There were a bunch of Republicans in Damascus last week talking to Assad. Nancy Pelosi, in the middle of two Republican trips to Damascus, goes to Damascus, and the Washington Post editorializes against her. Fox News is railing on her. All the Republicans are all having a hysterical hissy fit. Well, it seems like, you know, that's the big deal. It's really micro to the macro. It's really small to the large. And the macro is that nobody would give a hoot about what's going on in the Middle East, broadly speaking, if it wasn't one of the world's oil centers. Now, the major suppliers of oil to the United States are Mexico and Canada, although we get a fair amount of it from the Middle East. But Middle Eastern oil is it's in play. India's fighting for it. China's fighting for it. Russia, Europe, everybody is buying that oil. Mexico and Canada. And Mexico now, according to the Wall Street Journal today, front page, Mexico's major oil field, the Canada oil field, going into decline 10% a year. Within a few years, Mexico is going to lose 40% of the total revenue that the federal government has in that country, and they're going to have to import oil. This could be an absolute disaster. Jay in San Diego. Hey, Jay, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I wanted to mention that this was reported back in the L.A. Times as well back in February, so I'm really glad that it's still getting some media play because it's such a crucial story. And sitting here on the border with Mexico, if their economy just tanks any further, it's going to make the current immigration crisis look kind of pale in comparison, and it's going to put such an impact on the services costs for the state and for the federal.
It's going to go way beyond that. I mean, you're going to have, when you have a state crash like that, the first thing that they're going to take out is all their social services. They take out all their social services, you're going to see the people rise up. You're going to see a leftist, a rise, which is going to be overreactionary. It's a hyper-reactionary, which is, revolts in the streets, protests. It's going to be a replay of Nicaragua, 25 years ago or worse. And of course, the response from the United States in all probability will be to fund the right-wingers. And then you're going to see the paramilitaries and the whole meltdown. And you're going to see a state at war, internal civil war.
Yeah, you could have a second Mexican revolution, which the last one was pretty horrible for them and didn't impact us quite as much, but this next one really
spot
be
on
horrible.
This could be, and we need to be attending to this. We need to be attending
Absolutely.
To it with regard to national thank you Jay. We need to be attending to it with regard to national energy policy and national foreign policy, frankly, foreign policy even as close as our own borders. Peter in Berkeley, California. Hey, Peter.
Hi. I was listening to talking about needing to use less oil. And I've listened a lot, and I was thinking about what a lot of the right-wingers say, the people from Ayn Rand and all that. And I was thinking, what if maybe this has been tried already, but what if there was like a state-sponsored car company, electric car company, maybe recruit some auto executives to run it, just use government money for capital, and then have it just compete in the marketplace directly against existing car companies to see if they could force them to start making electric cars.
No, there's a much easier way to do it. First of all, my personal take on this, Peter, is that I don't want the government making anything. I want them administering the commons. They do a very good job of that. I don't want them in manufacturing. Because whenever you look at governments that have done manufacturing, it hasn't been done pretty all that well. I remember Trebbies in Germany, the East German car that was made by the state auto company, and they were no fun. The flip side of that, though, is there's a very simple solution. If you want to, for example, support electric cars, you do it the way that we did back in the 40s, I believe it was, when we first put this policy into place. It might have been the 1950s. And you say, we will allow you to deduct from your income taxes as a deduction any interest that you pay on a car loan if that car gets more than 40 miles per gallon. Or if that car gets more than 50 miles per gallon, or if that car gets more than 60 miles per gallon. Very, very simple change in the tax law. And when we did that with home mortgages, when we said you can deduct the cost of your mortgage if you buy a home, but you can't deduct the cost of rent, what happened? We went from being a nation of renters in the 1920s and 30s to being a nation of homeowners today. It was that fast. And that's how tax policy and government policy can drive, consumer behavior. And frankly, I think that would be the way that I would go. I salute you, by the way, for thinking outside the box and trying to get ahead of this thing, and it's something that we need to be doing. But frankly, that's the way. If government's going to get involved, that's the way I would do it. I would do it. Julian in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hey, Julian.
Hi, Tom. I've heard that there are two theories as to what oil actually is. The popular theory is that it's a fossil fuel, The other theory that isn't as well known is that it's merely hydrocarbons that were trapped in the earth at the time of its formation, and that if we dig deep enough, there's plenty of it.
Well, and there's a third theory, and that was put forth by a scientist by the name of Gold in a paper that he published in as I recall, something letters, geothermal letters or whatever, and his paper was called the Hot Deep Biosphere, as I recall, and his hypothesis was that there is hyperthermophilic bacteria, if I have the word right, bacteria that live at very, very, very high temperatures, and those bacteria deep under the earth, I mean, where there's high pressure and high temperature, converted indigenous carbon that was there, you know, from the start from the beginning of this planet, from the
right.
formation of this planet, converted that carbon into fossil fuels. And he said that the way that you would test for this is you would see the signature of the bacteria by the presence of hydrogen in the oil. And in fact, there is small amounts of hydrogen in oil. And so he's probably right. There probably is something to that. But that still, it still requires millions, if not tens or hundreds of millions of years for that bacteria to slowly crunch away at that rock, I forget the word for, you know, base rock-based carbon, but for that, you know, naturally occurring carbon to be converted into oil and accumulated in huge quantities. So, you know, people say, well, what about Gold's hypothesis? Yes, I acknowledge that in my book, Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. Still, you're talking about a carbon fuel, and then you've got the problem of carbon in the atmosphere. Of course, it even goes beyond that. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. I just wanted to throw out a few thoughts I had about the issue of oil. And first of all, I just wanted to put out that I've been slobbering for a affordable plug-in hybrid, and I've been hearing about the Tesla Roadster is out there, but it's going for $80,000. But I'm just waiting for one to get on the market myself. But anyway, I have a few suggestions about what to do about this oil business. First of all, it occurs to me, and this is just the first thing I think you'd agree with, is that the military, of course, is providing an enormous subsidy for the price of oil right now. It artificially brings down the price of oil by using force. That we pay for as taxpayers to...
Right. The best estimate is that the total tax bill to us divided by the total number of gallons of gasoline sold in the United States works out to we're paying about $4 per gallon of gasoline in addition to what we're paying for gasoline for the cost of having our military defend shipping lanes to bring that oil to the United States.
Absolutely. So the real cost, now if we weren't using force and killing people essentially to drive down the price of oil by, you know, subsidizing foreign imports, you know, by force, we'd be paying $7 or $8 a gallon. Now, here's on the other side of things. If the price of oil of gas was $7 or $8 a gallon, I would bet your bottom dollar that oil companies would be scrambling to find new ways of getting oil out of the ground, and not just
They already are, Jeff. Because they see this coming down the road. I mean, they've seen a doubling of the cost of the price of a barrel of oil, the tripling of the price of a barrel of oil just in the last 5 years.
Well, but the more it goes up and the faster it goes up, the more they scramble. I mean, for example, like to take the idea of coal gasification, I don't even think we've seen how far we could take that kind of technology. Coal, of course, is a fairly limitless resource in the United States. I mean, you know, we haven't even begun to tap that, but I don't think there's much incentive now to do that, with our military essentially, you know, doing evil.
Well, keep in mind, the military is also the single largest consumer of petroleum products in the United States.
Well, yeah, there
I mean,
you
they're,
go.
They're using a mind-boggling amount of oil as well. So you would think that they would have some sort of an interest in developing technologies that don't use fossil fuels and also, I mean, all of this assumes, I mean, this discussion, Jeff, about, you know, is there more oil? Will the rising price of oil encourage, you know, more exploration, more drilling, which is the Ayn Rand, the libertarian argument, assumes that it's a good thing that there be more oil. And I would argue that it's a bad thing. And that what we need to, if we're going to use fossil fuels, we need quickly to figure out ways to sequester the carbon that is being released or carbon neutral forms of emission, you know, like some of the coal technologies where you actually catch the carbon as it's coming out of the smokestack and lock it up with calcium as calcium carbonate, as rock. Or let's develop systems. It's not like we don't have them. I mean, there's enough sunlight that falls on the United States in a day to supply this nation with energy for a year. Let's start capturing some of the energy that's all around us post-fossil fuels. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-227. This is Tom Hartman on AirAmericaRadio.com.
This I know, I'll tell you. It is time for, frankly, I would not say revolution, I'd say impeachment, but close enough. 9.5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. By the way, just a quick call out to our friends listening up in Seattle on Talk 1090. Friday night, I think it's Friday night at 7. This email I have here also mentioned Saturday. I believe it's Friday night. Ralph Nader is going to be doing his movie, An Unreasonable Man, is going to be playing there at the Varsity Theater, and then he's going to be doing a live question and answer thing by teleconference or whatever it is, iCast it's called, with the listeners. And you can get more information about that. You can probably easily Google it or figure it out, or you can check out Not a Number, Cards and Gifts, a regular sponsor on Talk 1090, has all the information. And this summer, we will be doing this program live, June 3rd through 9th, live from Dubrovnik, Croatia. I have traveled all over the world, as longtime listeners know well, and lived all over the world. But I've never been to Croatia. I'm really looking forward to this. The Praxis Peace Conference, Praxis, peace.org. Rianne Eisler, Tom Hayden, Hazel Henderson of Beyond Globalization, George Lakoff, David Corton, Swami Beyond Ananda. There's going to be a bunch of us, and we're going to be doing this gig, this Praxis Peace Conference, and you can get information about that at Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, peace.org if you want to join us. Chris in Eugene, Oregon. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tom.
What's up?
Yeah, listening to talk about oil, and in response to a previous caller that mentioned Tesla Motors, lots of oil gets used in transportation. The electric car, all electric, is the way to go with this. I think it needs to be capitalized in a big way. There's another part of the transportation equation in jet fuel. And I think a thing that we ought to be doing is capitalizing, rebuilding the rail beds to handle 300-mile-an-hour magnetic levitation trains. And it should be a North American initiative where we're building these things through Mexico, Canada, and the United States, and use the technology of the inducted levitation using the Halbach
array. Which is used
array.
In Japan right now, by the way.
I'm sorry?
It's used in Japan right now.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure that's Halbach array. The Halbach array inducted energy method is far superior to the
I'm not familiar with the subtleties of all the various types, but spot on. Yes, we need to be building a national mass transit infrastructure, and it needs to be based on electricity because we can pull electricity from sunlight quite efficiently. Bill in the Queens, hey Bill, or Queens, New York, rather. Hey Bill.
Hey, how you doing? A few points. So first on gas prices, if they go up. Well, that's great because, you know, at some point we need to start deterring car usage in this country as part of a plan over the next coming decades to cut.
Yeah, in the abstract, spot on, and I absolutely agree with you. However, we also need to recognize the fact that as gas prices go up, who gets hurt? Independent truckers, people who drive for a living and you know, frankly, have probably no choice in that, since any kind of job that doesn't depend on being anchored to the United States is being offshored in one way or another, and the poor, basically, who
right.
are
well,
having
it would
to transport themselves
national.
To work.
National energy policy that would have taxation adjustments to help those who need it and not to help those like the oil companies who don't need it. Now the other
at the very least, yes.
The other point is, which you've already touched on, is that even if a new Saudi Arabian oil field was found, You can't just plunder it because of global warming. We're going to have to cut back on oil usage over the coming years anyway. And the last guy who spoke, you know, the biggest news last week was this French train at 357 miles an hour, and the fact that not only are Western Europe and Japan way ahead of us in this field, but even China and India are planning to make huge $100 billion or more investments in these high-speed train networks, and the U.S. has crumbling Amtrak, which can't even.
And we're doing absolutely nothing. And you know why? Because we have an administration that does not believe in investing in infrastructure. They don't believe that they will not combine the word invest with the word government because of this right-wing ideology that says that anything the government does is an expense, not an investment. And we have had, ever since Ronald Reagan came in as president, we have had a mentality running this country for the last 26 years that says that you can't invest in government. And the fact of the matter is that we invested in government very heavily from the 1930s to the 1980s, and the result of that was a powerful, vital, productive infrastructure of public education, transportation, and everything else that enabled America to become a powerful and great nation. And they have been systematically deconstructing it ever since Reagan came into office. Spot on and well said. Thank you very much. Kevin in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Kevin.
Hi, Tom. Hey, I just want to address the Manhattan Project. We do have one, and it does solve our energy problem. It solves global warming. It solves nuclear proliferation, and they're building it right now in France. It's called the ITER. I believe it's International Test Experimental Reactor. And what they do is it's a nuclear reactor. Instead of accessing the energy in an atom by taking a large atom like uranium or plutonium and trying to split it, what they do is they take a very small atom, which is isotopes of hydrogen, and they, using heat and pressure, push them together, create a plasma.
Right, nuclear fusion rather than nuclear.
Nuclear fusion.
Yeah,
exactly.
And you know, if it works, it would be a great thing. And I'm frankly skeptical. One of the problems of nuclear fusion is that it also produces a whole variety of types of radiation. But, you know, yes, if we can develop this and we can make it work, great. Right at the moment, it's, as far as I can tell, not ready for prime time. I mean, I'm just in favor of simple stuff. I think that if the extent to which we can localize energy, if a neighborhood, there was an article in the paper today, I believe it was in the Wall Street Journal, about how this soldier in Iraq was helping two square block areas build basically barriers around their two square blocks and separating Shia from Sunni communities and thus decreasing the death toll. We should be doing the same thing with regard to energy. Every small neighborhood should become energy independent. And how do you do that? Solar collectors on the roof. Coming up next, Dr. Paul Cameron.
Tom Hartman is excellent. He's bright. He's personable.
Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Now, Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, defending America from the weapons of mass deception.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour, the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. The go-to guy when the right wing wants to bash gays is Dr. Paul Cameron. He's chairman of the Family Research Institute, familyresearchinst.org, the website. He's proposed the tattooing and quarantining of AIDS patients, raised the possibility of exterminating gay men. Is that true, Paul Cameron, what I'm reading here?
No, I don't think so. I have. Proposed when AIDS began that those who were spreading it should be tattooed so that those who might be infected could at least get a warning.
I've changed my mind.
It doesn't look like warning people does much good.
Okay, and your Family Research Institute has Robert Dornan, the congressman from California, on your advisory board.
Yep.
Okay, you've got a new study out here. And by the way, we should add that you are a practicing heterosexual, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I find it interesting that you know, guys who want to bash gays are always saying homosexual to be sure to get the word sexual in there. So let's be clear that you are a heterosexual. You have this new study out, federal distortion of homosexual footprint, ignoring early gay death. And,
right.
And it's getting all over the right-wing blogosphere, and all the radio shows have you on, and you actually sent out a news release. We got it, and here we are. Homosexual marriages or partnerships have been legal in Denmark since 89 and Norway since 93. And you go back and look at those numbers, and you come to some startling conclusions.
Yeah, I think so, as you know. During the 90s, we collected a bunch of obituaries here in the States, and we said, boy, it sure looks like the homosexual lifespan is very brief. But people said, well, these are obituaries, and they're in the gay press, and who knows? You know, maybe everybody doesn't get in there. Maybe the homosexuals do live as long. Well, I think this data is very near definitive. Because this is in a situation, these two countries, Norway and Denmark, do not discriminate against those who engage in homosexuality. In fact, they allow them to marry. And in these married relationships, the average age of death pretty well matches what we found here in the States. That is 52 years of age for gays, 56 for lesbians. Now, that is markedly different from in the same countries, including our own.
No.
Married men and women, usually married guys somewhere
living in their 70s.
The gals toward the end of the 70s.
Right.
The
80s. So, you know, I looked at your study. I'm reluctant, frankly, to call this a study because you have such a small sample, and you yourself actually in it. I'll give you this. You acknowledge the fact that your data is probably unreliable and it's a small sample. But beyond that, you're looking. A gay marriage has only been legal in Denmark since 89 and in Norway since 93. And one of the main points that you make in your study is that there's a fall off in older gays among your sample. And you're assuming that fall off means that they're dead. I would submit to you that there's a fall off in people who are self-confessed gays or homosexuals, as you would say, because if somebody's over 60, they grew up at a time when being gay meant you'd get beaten to death if anybody found out about it, or in many countries you get put in prison.
Well, you got a point. No one can say until you actually have the hard data in front of you what the truth is, but notice we have...
Well, if I have a point, why are you running around telling people that gays die young when your data doesn't support it?
Oh, no. The data does. It's consistent with that. And then we have the data from Canada. Now, Canada is a very key chunk of information. This is the largest sex survey ever done in the history of man, 121,000 people. And the Canadian government and the Canadian Census Bureau only released the numbers and the proportions of people who claim to be homosexual or engage in homosexuality recently up through the age of 59. We had to pay. I and my colleagues had to pay Statistics Canada for the rest of the data. And when you get the rest of the story, instead of 1.7% of adults as the initial release went out, it turns out 1.4% of adults say they either had engaged in or considered themselves to be homosexuals. Now, what that means practically is about one out of every 50 younger adults engages in homosexuality or considers themselves homosexual. When you get to older ages, over the age of 60, it's one out of 233.
And I would change your language because I think it's imprecise. You're saying one out of 50 engages in, one out of 253 engages in, and that's actually not what's being measured here. What's being measured is how many will tell somebody who's asking the questions that they engage in it.
That's true.
You know, let's be honest about this.
No one except the person who does it knows what they actually do.
Which brings me back to my original point. Here's my perspective on this. When I was a kid growing up, one of my grandfather's brothers was gay and lived with a partner, and it was sort of like the kind of family secret. I mean, nobody talked about it. Everybody knew, but nobody actually. I didn't know until I was a teenager. I didn't figure it out, but it was a wonderful old guy. You know, he was my grandfather's age or a little older, but. It was something that just nobody ever talked about, and so because it was you know, not accepted back then, not socially accepted. So what this study in Canada is finding is that, you know, 0.3% of people over 60 are, 0.3% are fewer are willing to self-identify as being gay. I would say that that has to do with the fact that those are people, again, who grew up when being gay was a crime, and admitting it out loud would subject you to persecution or even not just prosecution, but persecution, beatings, torture, death, the things that are, frankly, in my opinion, inflamed by the kind of rhetoric, the rhetorical arguments that you're making.
Well, first out, let me cede that I don't have hard data from Canada. What we have is hard data consistent with what we're finding in Denmark and Norway. Now realize,
which is
in Denmark and Norway,
likely to say, yes, I'm gay.
Pardon me?
Which is that older men are less likely to say, yes, I'm gay.
I don't know.
That's my point.
Well, yes, they're less apt to say they're gay. But it makes sense if, in fact, the reason they don't say that is there are very few of them left alive. And study.
But you don't know that.
Study. Well,
you don't know that. I mean, you're.
But here we have Denmark and Norway, where about 3% of homosexuals over there, as near as we can tell, and the British researchers agree with us out of the very group that we're criticizing, about 3% of gays get married, and of those that get married, they are having the decency to die, so to speak, on time with what we've found here in the United States. Now, that doesn't prove beyond any reasonable doubt, but it certainly proves beyond...
Your statistics, you know, when you go to a gay magazine where you're getting the obituaries of people who are active in the gay community, they're out there, they're visible, they're more likely to have their name show up in the obituaries, and if they die young, and that's a news event, if nothing else, that doesn't demonstrate that you've got higher death rates. Let me just pull this back for a second here. We're talking with Paul Cameron, the Family Research Institute. The argument that you're buttressing with this entire thing, what you're doing is you're using this to say that gay couples should not be allowed to adopt because they're going to die sooner anyway, and therefore they wouldn't be good parents because they won't be around. And that's correct.
That's part of the logic here.
I think that's reprehensible.
Well, first of all, let's look at the death statistics. No one has experimentally proven that smoking causes early death. What we have is a series of relationships in which we look at people who smoke and we notice that they're...
Have you looked at the number of children who were adopted by gay couples who suddenly found themselves parentless?
Oh, yes. We have ample evidence.
No, you haven't.
We do. What we don't have is... a total sample. What would tie the knot on this?
So what? You found a couple of obituaries in gay publications
by homosexuals, and then we found out what proportion of those were orphaned or left, with two parents that are divorced.
Paul Cameron, we just have a few seconds left. Why the war on gays?
It's not a war. It's when people don't hold up their part of the sky, they don't deserve to be encouraged to continue in that habit. Just as when you smoke, you're harming others besides yourself. When you engage in homosexuality, you harm all of society much worse than smokers.
Okay. Paul Cameron, chairman of the Family Research Institute, familyresearchinst.org. Thanks for talking with us, Paul.
You bet. Take it.
16 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-2270.
Hi, I'm Moby.
I'm Edie Falco.
Hello, I'm Mike Myers.
And you're listening to Air America Radio.
Air America Radio.
And you're listening to Air America Radio.
AirAmericaRadio.com. The Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Well, there's many a strange impulse out on the plains of West Texas. There's many a young boy who feels things he can't comprehend. And a small town don't like it when somebody falls between sexes. No, a small town don't like it when a cowboy has feelings for men. I believe to my soul that inside every man there's the feminine. And inside every lady there's the deep manly voice, loud and clear. Well, the cowboy may brag about things that he's done with his women, but the ones that brag loudest are the ones that are most likely queer.
It's never been tried before! 22 minutes past the hour, by the way. Welcome back, and thank you, Willie, for that. It's never been tried before. These are more or less verbatim quotes. The Bible doesn't mention it. Civilized people have never done things this way. No society in the 6,000 years of the history of civilization has ever suggested such a thing. It'll create social chaos, ultimately destroying the nation. It's just too radical an idea for people to accept. Those are all quotes that I pulled together. You'll find it in a piece I wrote in Common Dreams back in 2004 called Gay Marriage, Blame It on Jefferson. Those are all quotes from the 1760s about the United States establishing democracy, about the idea of democracy. The gay rights are merely an extension of the idea of human rights that were put forward in the 1770s, and the same arguments against gay rights are the same arguments that have been made against rights of women, the rights of African Americans, the rights of interracial couples, the whole thing all the way along. My friend Sam Cedar is with us. His book, FUBAR, has actually a paragraph in it from, first of all, hey, Sam.
How you doing, Tom? I got to tell you, when I walked into my office and I heard, I thought, oh, this is a funny sketch. And then I realized it was Cameron. And
it's deadly serious stuff here.
It's very serious. And
he is out during the circuit right now, and he's doing all the right-wing talk shows and all this kind of stuff. And I just want to put a lie to what he's talking about. And so I think it's important to bring him on and let him have his say and then just knock it back down. And in your book, FUBAR, which is a brilliant book, you've got a quote from him. Can you share that with
us? Yeah, I will. I mean, I thought when you mentioned the fact that people who are talking about gays always say homosexual and include that sexual part in there was pretty appropriate, because he has a quote from an article in Rolling Stone magazine that Robert Dreyfuss did. And it says, he said, the evidence is that men do a better job on men and women on women if all you're looking for is orgasm. I'm convinced that lesbians are particularly good seducers. It's pure sexuality. It's almost like pure heroin. It's such a rush. They are committed in
almost... This guy put a lot of thought into this.
when I would do this at the book reading, I would do it with a sort of a shaky, sweaty kind of feel.
Yeah, well, go for it.
And they'll take enormous risks, do anything. Marital sex tends towards the boring end. Generally, it doesn't deliver the kind of sheer sexual pleasure that homosexual sex does.
Oh, my. This is Paul Cameron, right?
He sounds like he's done a lot of research.
Yeah,
and, we mentioned in the book our condolences to Mrs. Cameron for the
boring sex
end.
Life.
Yes,
yeah.
Sorry about that.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Gift baskets of oil, welcome, I guess.
There you go. Sam Cedar, thanks a lot for dropping
Tom.
In and sharing that with us. I appreciate it. It's great to have you here. I am firmly of the opinion, first of all, that most homophobia is rooted in repressed homosexuality or gayness or whatever you want to call it, number one. And number two, that we just go back and look at the history of civil rights in the United States, of whether it's, and I'm talking about truly civil rights. I mean, you can go back to 1215, the arguments about whether or not King John should have signed the Magna Carta. Go to the 1680s, the bloodless revolution, what was it called, the Glorious Revolution in England, the arguments against there being a Bill of Rights in England, against, overthrowing Oliver Cromwell and replacing him with Charles II and then James II, with a Bill of Rights in place, as I recall, if my recollection of British history is right. And those arguments all broke down to essentially the same arguments that, by and large, are being used against civil rights for gays, which are things like, well, we've never done it this way. The Bible doesn't endorse this. This isn't the way that civilization is done. This is going to create chaos. This is too radical an idea. And every step along the way in the evolution of human society, when people have come forward and said, hey, wait a minute, there are some of us who are left behind. Child labor. There are kids working in the mills. Well, that's the way it's supposed to be, don't you know? It's the way it's always been. No, let's have civil rights. Let's encourage more rights for people, not fewer. And let's not use junk science. I'm sorry. Let's not use junk science to justify what is essentially bigotry, in my humble opinion. I mean, we gave Paul his say, and he's out there, passing the word around. And I hope that in some small way we are immunizing you. Because this will be, now that he's got this new study out, it will be on Fox TV, and it will be on all the right-wing blogs, and it's going to be all over the place, because he's getting all over the place. When we get multiple inquiries from right-wing sites that are just doing mass blasts to talk show hosts all across the country, hey, this is a guy you want to have on as a guest, then we know that we're a little ahead of the right-wing news curve here. It's coming. 27, no pun intended, 27 minutes past the hour.
Tom Hartman on AirAmericaRadio.com.
The dream is fading, now I'm staring at the door. I know it's over cause my feet have hit the cold floor. Check my reflection, I ain't feeling what I see. It's no mystery. Whatever happened to a passion I could live for? What became of the flame that made me feel more? And when did I forget that I was made to love you? I was made to find you. I was made just for you. Made to adore you. I was made to love.
It's the place where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Or at least civil rights for all humans. Let's say, actually, for all life forms. Frankly, we all have to, without the bugs and the bees and the plants and the trees and boy, the bees are crashing. We've got to do a show on that and what's causing all that. Anyhow, we need to acknowledge it all. Welcome back. 35 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Kurt in Ventura, California. Hey, Kurt, welcome to the program.
Hey, I had 2 points to make. One is when they do double-blind test studies on where no names and anything is shown, on the curve of straight to gay, they find that most people, the curve goes up in the middle, more toward the gay than toward the straight. However, when their faces are shown, it's the absolute reverse. And two, most of the people that are reaching around their 60s right now were during the time, if you look back, to about the same time as during the AIDS epidemic. So, of course, you're going to lose a whole bunch of people at that age.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I hadn't considered that. I was assuming that it just had to do with, those are people who were living in a time when there was, oppression and suppression of gay behavior, both legally and culturally. But you're right. There also was that, period of time where we didn't know what it was and we didn't have a cure for it, and a whole lot of people died, including
exactly.
A couple of very good friends of mine. Yeah, good point, Kurt. Thank you very much for that. I appreciate
sure.
it. Good to hear from you. Michael in the Bronx. Hey, are you in Bronx? For some reason, Michael, all my life I've referred to Bronx as the Bronx. What am I missing? Michael? Oh, apparently Michael ain't there. We'll come back to him. Let's try Neil in Grover Beach, California. Hey, Neil.
Yeah, hey, how are you?
Just great. What's up?
Well, I'm a self-diagnosed heterosexual male, and I've done an informal study of my own with my friends and acquaintances, and any time I ask another self-proclaimed heterosexual, if it's just as easy for them to have sex with another male as it is to have sex with a female, the answer, strangely, is always no. And I've encouraged them to ask everyone they know that claims to be a heterosexual if they can have sex with the same sex. Therefore, the question becomes, how are they defining this word choice?
Right. The bottom line is this is not a choice. I mean, the other question that goes along with that, Neil, is to ask people, at what age did you realize that you were a heterosexual? And, most straight people will say, it never occurred to me that there's a particular age. I've just always known I'm the way I am. You ask most gay men or women, for that matter, at what age did you realize that you were gay? They'll say, it never occurred to me that for some people, I suppose there was an epiphanous moment when they realized they were out of sync with society, but what seems to be society. But they would say, no, I've always been this way.
If it's only a choice for gay people to be gay, then it's not really a choice at all.
Yeah, yeah,
so when
absolutely.
When you define the term, choice.
Good point. Good point and well made, Neil. Thank you. Jim in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Yes, there is. In the book of Romans, chapter 1, verses 21 through 28, clearly defines homosexuality. I don't say it per se, but it does say where the woman will take the natural use one to another, and also the male doing the same
thing. Oh, you're disagreeing with my statement that Jesus never condemned homosexuality. The book of Romans was written by Paul, not by Jesus. Jesus
was
long gone by that time.
Yes, but it was inspired by the Holy Spirit. All
well, but it's still, you cannot give me a quote from Jesus condemning homosexuality that doesn't exist.
Well,
and, you know, quoting Paul, I'm sorry, you know, he said a lot of nice things. Paul said that women should wear their heads covered when they go to church and they should not speak up. Do you want to start having all women go into churches with their heads covered and forbid them from speaking?
No.
Okay, well, was that inspired by the Holy Spirit? Paul said it.
Yes,
right there in Romans.
The Bible is the inspired word of the Creator.
So then we should tell women that they have to start wearing headscarves in churches.
That's what their
hair is. And that they can't speak out.
That's what their hair is for.
No. Paul said a scarf. He didn't say hair. He said a scarf. Their head should be covered.
Well, that's depending on what version of the Bible you pick up.
Oh, okay. Well, no, Jim, I understand your point, but you will not find, and thank you for the call. Good try. But you will not find, and even if you could, I mean, it's still, this should, frankly, in my opinion, not be a religious issue. We're talking, this is a nation of laws, not a nation of religion. Brax in La Union, New Mexico. Hey, Brax.
Hey, Tom. Great to hear you. And thanks for putting me on after that guy. That's easy. The key term here, I think, it's the 21st century. We have to start using the term witch hunt. Anybody who's out to, and it's persecute, gays, is somebody who's a bigot. And it's just, that's just the plain and simple truth. There is, no evidence to suggest that homosexuality is a mental disorder that's been taken out of the DMS 3 and 4. And yes, people do have persecution complexes. They may have a post-traumatic stress disorder from being persecuted, but that's not the same as something wrong with their sexual identity. And the last thing I want to say is we need to change our society. We have a elitist, bigoted society that will pick on anybody to get themselves off. Thanks a lot.
Yeah. Sure, you're welcome, Brax. Well said. And in fact, to the north of us in Canada, they allow gay marriage. To the south of us in Mexico, they allow gay marriage. And I haven't seen either one of those societies melt down in the last few weeks. Actually, Massachusetts allows gay marriage. And Mitt Romney, the governor who signed the bill, or whatever it was, I wasn't there when it happened, but Mitt Romney, who oversaw it, is he's the biggest fundraiser for the Republicans. I mean, you know, come on, let's come into the 21st century. Ruth in Manhattan. Hey, Ruth.
Hey, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
I'm great. Sure.
That guy was saying about, my point is smokers die young. People who smoke cigarettes, though, don't let them adopt.
Yeah, that's the perfect rebuttal to Paul Cameron's suggestion that, first of all, I don't accept his statistics, but even if there was some accuracy to them that gays were to die slightly younger than straights, they shouldn't be adopting. It's nuts, but you're right. Smokers die. Good point. Well said, Ruth. Thank you very much. Angela in Oakland, California. Hey, Angela.
Hey, Tom. Good to hear from you. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm still a little bit frazzled after the Paul Cameron interview. I'm sorry.
Me too.
Just
nothing like a little adrenaline.
It just boggles my mind in the morning. I don't know why I'm not used to the rhetoric by now, but, you know, every now and again you get, we need to really hammer home that this guy, I mean, do we need to remind people of Ted Haggard? I mean, we really
exactly.
need to remind people that this is just repressed homosexuality at its, like, peak example.
In all probability, or it's some, you know, some sort of bigotry that has some sort of root that we don't understand. I mean, I don't understand. Actually, I suppose I can understand, you know, racial bias and prejudice or cultural bias and prejudice or whatever, because it all kind of goes back to that natural human instinct to protect family and community, and to say, oh, that person looks like the other. And I suppose, you know, at some level, maybe some anti-gay stuff comes out of that. Those are all instincts that we carry that probably helps us survive as hunter-gatherers that are, frankly, all not all that useful right now. And, in fact, arguably destructive. And we need to, I think the history of our civilization is overcoming those instincts or impulses or whatever to identify the other and then oppress the other, and instead to welcome everybody into the family of humanity. It's the, you know, yeah. Angela, thank you for the call. Lynn in Tacoma, Washington. Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Tom. I love your program. I totally get offended when people say, well, the Bible says this, you know, homosexuality is wrong. I say, well, what if that's not something that rules your life? Then what could you say? That's just another point. But I'm sure Jesus wasn't against homosexuals because it's natural. I think.
Well, that, I mean, look at the Da Vinci. You know, Leonardo wasn't there when it happened, but look at the painting of the Last Supper. You know, Jesus and John are a little close, shall we say. But
anyway. I wanted to comment about the Iran hostages being freed, the sailors.
Yeah.
I think that the Bush administration's being totally quiet about it because they're really upset that it's not going to be able to help them spur an international incident.
I agree. That's it was the gist. Yeah, I agree, Lynn. Thank you very much. That was the gist of my conversation with Cy Hirsch. Was it yesterday, the day before? Was that, you know, Bush really needs this to be able to go after these guys. Sean in Orcas Island, Washington. Hey, Sean, just a few seconds before we've got to take a break here. Is it a quick point?
Oh, wow. Hey, yay. Okay, listen. I just finished a book called Religion Gone Bad, The Hidden Dangers of the Christian Right by Mel White. Was a ghostwriter for Jerry Falwell and Robertson and others, and Billy Graham included. He written a book that tells you and shows you very, very clearly how covert this whole plan is to replace our constitutional democracy with a system built on liberal biblical law.
You're right. These people are called dominionists. You're absolutely right, Sean. They're called dominionists, and they do want to replace the Constitution with the Bible. And, in fact, they've funded, in fact, one of the largest voting machine companies in the United States in its earliest incarnation was funded by a group like that. It's a little spooky. And what's going on at the Air Force Academy? Gee, it's the last days. Let's get ready. I mean, yes, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, where despair is not an option. Get active. This is Air America Radio. The Tom Hartman Program on AirAmericaRadio.com.
It's the pillow will help you escape the matrix. Air America Radio, Progressive Talk Radio. Tom Hartman here with you 9 minutes before the hour. We're coming up on that in about 20, 30 seconds. And Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom. Well,
go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, if you were Alberto Gonzalez, you wouldn't be looking forward to the spring break because you wouldn't be getting a break.
Yeah.
You're working
poor Alberto. Yeah, he's being prepped. He's on our paycheck, on our nickel. He's being prepped. Here's the screaming headline that I'm finding interesting, because this is all over right-wing talk radio right now from everything that I'm reading. Daryl Issa is in Syria right now, and he criticized Bush, and specifically and explicitly criticized the Bush administration for not talking to Syria. Nancy Pelosi, now Daryl Issa is a Republican. He's there this minute as we speak. Nancy Pelosi, the Democrat, went to visit Mr. Assad, and she not only refused to criticize Bush, but she held a news conference in which she said there is not one inch of daylight or a phrase of words to that effect. I saw her say it last night. I just don't remember the exact words, but my recollection is she said there's not one inch of daylight between her position and Bush's position on you know, situations with regard to terrorism in the Middle East. And so she not only refused to condemn Bush, but she largely kind of endorsed him. And yet all the right-wing guys, I mean, you've got Suzanne Melveaux on CNN saying, isn't this, and this boggled my mind, saying, isn't this a publicity stunt, a political stunt, a big wet kiss to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad? You've got people who pretend to be news reporters who are apparently, it's Suzanne Melveaux on CNN, putting out Republican talking points about Nancy Pelosi, and yet none of the Republicans are willing to condemn Daryl Issa.
It is frankly astonishing, and I'm very surprised at Suzanne Melveaux for doing that. Very surprised.
Well, John Boehner, 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 the, what do you say it? How do you say it?
You just like saying Boehner.
I know, it's John Boehner, Boehner, Boehner. Boehner, no, is it Boehner or Boehner? Yeah, thank you, Boehner. I honestly mix up Boehner and Boehner, and so that's why I think I fall back to Boehner. But in any case, John, the Republican from Ohio, says it's okay for Republicans to visit Syria, just not Pelosi. This is from the Columbus, Ohio Dispatch. Boehner declined to criticize fellow Republican Congressman David Hobson for joining Pelosi, saying her stature gave the visit an imprimatur it didn't deserve. He said it's one thing for other members to go, but you have to ask yourself, why is Pelosi going? She's going for one reason, and that's to embarrass the president. She's the Speaker of the House. She's, you know, blah-de-blah. And Hobson, the Republican member of Congress who went along with Pelosi, said she did not engage in any bashing of Bush in any meeting I was in, and she did not in any meeting I was in bash the policies as it relates to Syria. So it seems like the Republicans are at war with each other.
How extraordinary.
Yeah.
The only thing really I can think of to say.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's fine. If I can shock a White House reporter, I've done good.
You shot me twice. You shot me with the Suzanne Melveaux thing. Now you shot me with that.
Yeah.
Now I'm reeling.
Okay. Well, as you really, what else is going on in Washington D.C. that we need to know about?
Well, very little, as a matter of fact. Everybody's out of town. They've either gone to California, followed by Crawford. Then the president, by the way, on Monday is going to Yuma, Arizona, for a speech on immigration, which will, of course, be a serious speech and not a photo op. He'll be doing that before he returns to Washington, D.C. Congress is out, as you
know. Are you speaking with tongue-in-cheek about serious speeches?
Moi?
Okay, all right. We'll let it pass.
How can you say so? How can you say so?
Right.
One person who is in town, of course, is Alberto Gonzalez, as he sweats and swats for his appearance on the 17th before the Senate Judiciary Committee. But you see, it's not as simple as that, because he has an appearance before, I think it's Senate Appropriations. I'm not sure which committee it is, but it's one of the committees this week, and where he's going to be asked about overall Justice Department stuff. Not specifically this. And Senator Patrick Leahy is going to sit in on that hearing.
Oh, that'll be interesting.
Oh, that's going to be very interesting. You can be assured I'll be there.
Yeah. This is, you know, Gonzalez, here, there's also Monica. She's now saying that she's not going to testify under oath, and she's now attacking the Democratic Party, Democrats in general, for I don't think she used the phrase witch hunt, but she used words, Monica Goodling, words to that effect. She's still refusing. She's refused to even show up for a private interview with Conyers and Sanchez. And so they're talking about.
I'm not sure she can do that.
Exactly. They're talking about, well, you know, Trafficante and Marcello tried it. They're talking about pulling her in front of Congress and just letting her take the fifth on a question-by-question basis. This seems like a good idea to me.
That, I think, is the way that it's generally been done. That's how it's done in the movies.
Yeah, there you go. Now, Orrin Hatch this week on one of the shows on Sunday, I think it was Face the Nation, says that Carol Lamb, quote, is a former law professor, has no prosecutorial experience, is the former campaign manager in Southern California for Clinton. All three of these things that Orrin Hatch said on national television, which were repeated yesterday or the day before yesterday by Limbaugh and other right-wing talk show hosts all across America, all of these things are plain old flat-out lies. Has Orrin Hatch apologized for this yet?
As far as I'm aware, he's not apologized. As far as I'm aware, he has no intention of apologizing.
But she's not. She was never a law professor. She was a prosecutor for 15 years, and she's a Republican and never served on the Clinton campaigns, which completely contradicts everything he said.
And he said it, and he's made it so.
That is how easy it is to make something reality now.
Well, actually, I would suggest you're probably right. I think probably for most people who watch Fox News and listen to right-wing talk radio, that now is reality, and they're going to, you know, have a very clear recollection of it.
Yes, that is reality.
Amazing, amazing. Good point. And very quickly, do you think that Bush's ability to attack Iran has been diminished by the release of the hostages?
No.
No. Oh, interesting. Okay. You and Cy Hirsch. Thank you very much. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com in Washington, D.C. Thanks, Victoria.
Thank you.
57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio.
Tom Hartman is excellent. He's bright. He's personable.
Tom Hartman on Air America Radio. Air America Radio proudly presents the Tom Hartman Program, Truth in Broadcasting.
Well, we have this weird confluence of events. Tom Hartman here with you, by the way. Welcome back to our program, the third hour of our program. On the website, censorship is spreading like crazy. A lot of it is being done by countries. A lot of it is being done by corporations. And a lot of it is being done by families, frankly. But I'm not so concerned about that. That's mostly to keep kids from having access to porn. But here we have, for example, in Turkey, they have blocked YouTube because there was a YouTube thing that was offensive, they thought, of Mr. Ataturk, the founder of modern Turkey. And, in fact, the Electronic Frontier Foundation did a survey. They found over 40 countries. They actually went into these countries and tried to access a variety of websites, over 1,000 websites, international news and other sites. This was the Open Net Initiative, a project of Harvard Law School and the Universities of Toronto, Cambridge, and Oxford. And they found that this trend of Internet censorship is spreading. 10 countries have become pervasive blockers, regularly prevent their citizens from seeing a range of online material. These include China, Iran, Saudi Arabia, Tunisia, Burma, and Uzbekistan. And then they have this whole variety of new censorship techniques, including the periodic barring of complete programs, applications like Wikipedia or Pakistan's ban on Google, down to keyword filtering. And perhaps most chilling, they note, methods such as these are being copied as countries new to censorship learn from those with much more experience. So, for example, some countries are learning from China, which has the most experience with Internet censorship. Zimbabwe, for example, is starting to use this same technology. Now, from that, we go to what's going on inside the United States. And this goes beyond just the Internet. This was Ann Zimmerman and Gary McWilliams reporting in yesterday's Wall Street Journal. Walmart Stores Inc. worker fired last month for intercepting a reporter's phone call says he was part of a larger, sophisticated surveillance operation that included snooping not only on employees, but on critics, stockholders, and the consulting firm McKinsey & Company. As part of the surveillance, I'm reading from the Wall Street Journal here. As part of the surveillance, the retailer last year had a long-haired employee infiltrate an anti-Walmart group to determine if it planned protests at the company's annual meeting. According to Bruce Gabbard, the fired security worker who worked in Walmart's threat research and analysis group. The company also deployed cutting-edge monitoring systems made by a supplier to the Defense Department that allowed it to capture and record the actions of anyone connected to its global computer network. That would include, by the way, well, let me just finish this paragraph. The system's high-tech wizardry could detect the degree of flesh tone on a viewed Internet image and alert monitors that a vendor sharing Walmart's networks was viewing pornography. And, in fact, that happened in one case. Somebody who's selling them products and therefore had access to their system or vice versa. You know, you go in and you say, yes, we're delivering the order on Thursday. Because of that system access, the Walmart surveillance folks were able to look into the activity happening on that vendor's computer and notice some guy looking at dirty pictures. Holy cow. Now, Walmart's surveillance activity, they note in the Wall Street Journal, appears to be legal. Walmart employees are informed they have no expectation of privacy when using company-supplied computers or phones, and the surveillance of people in public places is also legal. Walmart bars employees from using personal cell phones on the job. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Managers receive a list of email addresses and phone numbers their employees have communicated with and a list of websites visited. Now, you may think, oh, my employer would never do that. My manager doesn't receive a weekly list of every phone call I made and who's on the other end of that phone line and doesn't receive a copy of all of the emails that I sent and received. And certainly wouldn't see them if I used my private Hotmail or Yahoo or Google account, email account. Or what websites I visited. Not necessarily so. But Walmart appeared to go beyond most companies in its sleuthing. This, again, the Wall Street Journal. It didn't just scan emails written on the corporate email system. Technology it was helping develop allowed it to view emails that employees sent to or from private accounts such as Hotmail or Gmail whenever the employees were hooked into the Walmart computer network, according to Mr. Gabbard and others with knowledge of the system. These guys, they worked in the third floor of the Bentonville, Arkansas technology offices in an area that their colleagues called the Bat Cave. They enter a separate glass-enclosed structure by holding the palm of their hand to a biometric reader that grants them access to a dimly lit work area. The Wall Street Journal notes Walmart began beefing up its electronic call surveillance after 9/11. Later, he says, this Gabbard, the guy who is ratting out Walmart, that sounds negative, the guy who is whistleblowing on Walmart. Later, he says he used the same equipment to intercept and record calls from the New York Times. And then when Walmart Watch went online, I think it's walmartwatch.org, Walmart got very, very skittery. The electronic surveillance accelerated October 2005 when confidential company memos began appearing on the website of the union-backed anti-Walmart group. One such memo suggested that because of rising costs, and remember this internal memo that said that, you know, our health insurance costs are going up, so let's only hire healthy people. That'll drive down our health insurance costs. How do we know that we're only hiring healthy people? We make sure that everybody has to push carts around in the parking lot. If you're not healthy enough to push carts around the parking lot, we won't hire you. Or if you're not capable of doing that, if you have any kind of disability whatsoever. Now, I'm obviously this is not the language that Walmart used, but it's the I believe the essence of the leaked memo, and didn't you know, they were unhappy that it was leaked, shall we say. So they turned to Oakley Networks, Inc., a developer of inside threat management gear. One Oakley system is able to record an employee's computer keystrokes and deliver a TiVo-like replay of his or her computer activities. They also used an Oakley product to monitor suppliers' use of the Walmart network, monitoring for flesh tones, as I already told you about this. And they directed their surveillance operation at their shareholders. The list included the New York City Comptroller's Office and an 85-year-old retired science teacher, a fellow by the name of Sidney Kay, who owns $5 million worth of Walmart stock, and his 93-year-old sister, Hilda. Reached at his Dallas home, Mr. K scoffed at the notion that he posed a threat to Walmart's annual meeting. He says, I am a nobody. Well, you own $5 million worth of Walmart. They seem to think that you're a somebody. So the question, should corporations have the rights of humans? Should they have the ability, you know, should they enjoy the reasonable expectation of privacy? Should they be able to assert their First, Fourth, Fifth, 14th Amendment rights, and Fifth Amendment rights as well, throughout the workplace? And we've seen this over and over again. Dow, back in the 70s, as I recall, I'd have to pull out a copy of my own book, Unequal Protection, The Rise of Corporate Dominance and the Theft of Human Rights, to give you the case, the actual case. But there was somebody who said, you know, there's an illegal release of toxins going on here. to the EPA, and the EPA shows up and says, okay, we're here to do a surprise inspection, and the company said, no, you can't do that. And the EPA said, well, that's what we were created to do, and the company said, nope, sorry, you can't do that. We have Fourth Amendment rights of privacy. You need a search warrant. We are a person. And, you know, they went to the Supreme Court, and the company actually won. Yep, they're a person. Or, you know, Nike more recently asserting their First Amendment right to say things that may or may not be the truth in their advertising and PR. Took it to the Supreme Court. Now, it got kicked back down to the California court. The issue's still unresolved. Or big box retailers essentially asserting their 14th Amendment rights, or large hog farms, big agricultural operations, saying that you can't discriminate against us. It's the same as saying to an African-American that they can't eat at the lunch counter. So if when I walk into a place of business to my employer, they have the right to remain silent. They have the right of privacy. They have the right against discrimination and all these other rights. But I surrender voluntarily as an employee all my rights of privacy. They can watch my keystrokes. They can listen to my conversations. They can know everything about me. They can track everything that I'm doing. Is this right? I don't think so. Let me just put it out there. I don't think so. I think that there should be some reasonable limits on this. 16 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at 866-303-22. This is Tom Hartman on AirAmericaRadio.com.
Your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. 21 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black. This was about 50 years ago or so. He said, I do not believe the word person in the 14th Amendment includes corporations. Neither the history nor the language of the 14th Amendment justifies the belief that corporations are included within its protection. Here's what he was talking about. The 14th Amendment was passed in the 1870s after the Civil War, along with the 13th and the 15th Amendment, to ensure that African Americans could come into the mainstream of society. It says no person shall be denied equal protection under the law. In other words, everybody has access to all those constitutional rights and all the laws and all protection of the Constitution. Now, everybody understood in the 1870s when this was passed that they were referring to people, no person. The problem is that for most of the history of jurisprudence, there had been two ways of defining persons. There are natural persons, which is you and me, and there are artificial persons, which are churches, corporations, and governments. And there has to be some personhood for a church, a corporation, or a government so that they can do things like pay taxes and own property and be parties to lawsuits. So they had to have some kind of status. So in the 1880s, the railroads who had risen up and were trying to take over America. They'd already corrupted most of Congress. They had their guy Ulysses S. Grant in as president. They were taking over the Republican Party by the late 1880s. They had placed three other guys on the Supreme Court, three former railroad attorneys. The railroad started bringing cases. There was a whole series of them. They're referred to as the railroad tax cases before the Supreme Court, saying, hey, we are persons. You can't tax us one way in one jurisdiction or in one state and another way in another state, that is not equal protection under the law. And repeatedly, the Supreme Court said, no, you're not persons. No, you're not persons. No, you're not persons. This is about African Americans. It's not about corporations. Until finally, many history books will tell you, in 1886, in the Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad case, the Supreme Court finally said, okay, you're people. And of the 307 14th Amendment cases brought before the Supreme Court from that day until 1910, only 19 dealt with African Americans. 288 were corporations seeking the rights of natural persons. This is what Hugo Black was talking about 50 years later, 1960. So I went off looking for this thing because I first read about it in a book of the history of America written by a friend of mine. And the court said that corporations are persons. I guess it must be so. And so I went to the law library. When I lived in Vermont, it was just a few blocks away from the Supreme Court Library, and I walked in and I said to the head librarian there, I'm looking for that 1886 decision where, it says corporations are persons. He says, oh, you mean Santa Clara County versus Southern Pacific Railroad? I said, yeah, that's the one. He goes, oh, what's over here? And he pulls out literally a book published in 1888, the transcripts of the Supreme Court proceedings. He says, here you go. And he finds it and opens it and, blows the dust off. And I sat down and I read, this is like a 20-page decision. Written in 19th century legalese. And I sat down and I read the whole thing from beginning to end. And nowhere in that decision did it say corporations are persons. So I went back to Paul, the librarian, the head librarian there, and I said, I'm not finding this here. And he goes back and he says, well, gee, I don't know. Maybe did you read the headnote? And I said, what's a headnote? And he said, well, it's the commentary that the clerk of the court writes. So we flip back to the page before the beginning of the decision. In fact, the decision actually ruled without getting to the whole tax thing. In any case, so I read the headnote, and the headnote opens with this statement by the clerk of the court. Corporations are persons under the 14th Amendment and entitled to equal protection under the law. And I'm like, whoa, where'd that come from? It contradicts the decision. The decision actually said, no, corporations are not persons. So I printed out a copy of it, and I took it to a friend of mine who was a lawyer in Montpelier and laid it on his table and said, look at this. What do you think of this? And he reads along and reads through the thing, and he goes, yeah, you're right. This doesn't say corporations are persons. And then I shared it with the Secretary of State, and then I've shared it with a bunch of lawyers over the years since then, and everybody's like, yeah, the Supreme Court never said this. Now, the problem is that since that time, the Supreme Court has quoted that headnote, which has no legal standing. It's simply an opinion written by the clerk of the court. The clerk of the court, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, by the way, who formerly was the president of the New York and Newburgh Railroad, giving to the railroads this personhood. And now corporations, because prior to 1886, corporations did not have rights under the Constitution. Individuals did. Stockholders did. Individual human beings did. Corporations did not. And now they're claiming all these rights, and basically it's like the eggplant that ate Chicago. They're rising up and taking over the world, literally. I mean, 40% of all international trade is within individual corporations, one corporation to itself. And so the bottom line here is I think it's time that we take a serious look, we revisit this, and say, maybe we should reconsider this idea. Human beings fought for a long time to be persons. Maybe we should reconsider whether corporations are. And thus, I wrote a book about this called Unequal Protection, if you're interested in the topic. It is running amok, and this example of Walmart is the most recent example of it. I think it illustrates it very well. Your call's next, 27 minutes past the hour. Thirty-four minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank. 866-303-2270, our telephone number. TomHartman.com if you want to drop into our live chat room. AirAmerica.com for the blog and a link to the chat room. I believe we're in the process of getting one up there soon anyway. Larry in Seattle. Hey, Larry, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. Update on the Orrin Hatch comments on Meet the Press. Mm-hmm. Rachel Maddow, Air America, in the afternoon has been real hot on this, and she has a blog entry on Huffington Post that includes a letter from Orrin Hatch dated today, April 5th, to Tim Russert. Dear Tim, I would appreciate your help in correcting a mistake I made on your show last Sunday, April 1st. My comments about Carol Lam's record as a U.S. attorney were accurate, but I misspoke when making the point of discussing politically connected U.S. attorneys. I accidentally used her name instead of her predecessor, Alan Burson, who was appointed by President Bill Clinton. I sincerely regret making this error, and I wanted to make sure that you and your viewers had the correct information, signed Orrin Hatch.
So my comments were accurate, but my comments weren't accurate?
He says he sincerely regrets making the error, and he wants to make sure that the viewers have the correct information.
Well, Larry, thanks for the update. Aaron Hatch says, my comments about Carol Lamb, they were accurate, but I wasn't talking about her. I was talking about somebody else. When I said that she was appointed by Bill Clinton, I was actually referring to that woman who was appointed by Bill Clinton. When I said that she was a law professor, I was actually referring to that woman who was a law professor. And when I said that she didn't have any prosecutorial experience, I was actually referring to that woman who didn't have any prosecutorial experience. And that woman I was referring to has not been a federal prosecutor for, 6-7 years now? So why are we even talking about her? Very interesting. Elizabeth in Chandler, Arizona. Hey, Elizabeth, you got the same information?
I do. I heard about this story yesterday and it outraged me, and then you were talking about it this morning, so I went ahead and called Mr. Hatch's office and actually spoke with someone, and he let me know that he issued a public apology to Tim Russert and to Ms. Lamb. And
interesting.
I just thought that it would be a good thing if anybody else called and let them put some pressure on them that we don't believe their half-truths and lies and their games they play.
Yeah, and an apology that says that everything I said was accurate, but, a little lame. Thank you, Elizabeth. Good point and well made. And for that matter, what about all the right-wing talk show hosts who picked up Orrin Hatch's talking point and amplified it to the right-wing blogosphere to the point that you've got zombies all over America going, yep. And, about Carol Lamb, she was appointed by Bill Clinton. Yep, that's it. No doubt about it. Chris in Cave Creek, Arizona. Hey, Chris. Welcome to the program. Chris? No, Chris. Okay. We'll put Chris on hold. And let's go to Dan in San Diego. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Yeah, morning. While you were talking about whether a corporation is a person and so on and so forth,
yes,
I started thinking about the whole Gonzalez thing, and wouldn't it be interesting if you have all these defendants in federal cases, say somebody arrested for protesting or something like that, and they use the reasoning for change of venue and appeal a dismissal or whatever under the grounds that they couldn't get a fair trial because the prosecutor or judge was a Bush loyalist or a Rove crony?
Yeah, that there's probably basis for that, Dan. Frankly, I think that there's a lot of basis for that.
Yeah, and I had another thing on Darrell Issa and the criticism of Nancy Pelosi, and Issa goes over there. Now, he should come under suspicion because he's of, I believe, Lebanese descent or partial Lebanese descent, and he's overseas criticizing Bush like the Dixie Chicks did. They ought to round him up.
Yeah, well, they're not. John, and thanks, Dan. John Boehner says, no, we're not going to criticize him. After all, he's a Republican visiting Syria. That's a whole different thing. Steve in Los Angeles. Hey, Steve.
Hey, Tom. I got a thought here. If a corporation is a person, shouldn't they be held to the limits on a campaign of, I think it's $2,300?
Yeah, well, in some states actually, and this is one of those exceptions to the rule. Like in Texas, for example, I believe that it is illegal for corporations to give money to political campaigns. There was a federal law passed in 1907 under Teddy Roosevelt that absolutely forbade all corporate contributions to politicians. It's been amended and diluted so many times over the years that at the federal level, it pretty much is non-functional. But that has been tried and with some success. And so, good point. And thanks for listening to us on K-Talk there. My taking this, the next step is saying we need to go back to, it used to be that corporations, the first statement in their charter, in their articles of incorporation, because basically what a corporation is a bunch of people getting together, being given special protection by the government, special protection from liability. This is why they're called limited liability corporations. Special protections and special tax breaks and incentives in order to do business, because we consider business a desirable, positive, public, useful social good. And so we say, we will give you a bunch of benefits if you will do business. And we used to say, and by the way, you have certain responsibilities. And so the first article in your articles of incorporation had to say that the main purpose of the corporation was to serve the public good, and the secondary purpose was to make a profit. And secretaries of state had to examine whether every year corporate charters, and if those corporations were not serving the public good, they got dissolved. They got the death penalty. We used to say that corporations couldn't exist for more than 20, 30, or 40 years, depending on the state. Different states are different, but the goal was to always make a corporation last no longer than the productive lifespan of a person, the working lifespan of a person. We used to say that a corporation can only do one thing. If you're in the business of building railroads, that railroad cars, that's fine, but you can't also build oil wells, oil derricks or whatever. We used to say that a corporation can't own stock in another corporation. I mean, these were all the laws of the land prior to the 1880s and 1890s when the corporations rose up and took over this country. And things worked very well, thank you very much. So I think, you know, frankly, we should consider going back to some of those things. Joe in Long Island, New York. Hey, Joe.
Yeah, how you doing, Tom? What I was saying is, shouldn't it be incumbent on Tim Russert to announce on the air the retraction by Orrin Hatch, or shouldn't we pressure him to to make this retraction available and known over the air? Because just apologizing to Tim Russert after it goes out on the air doesn't do anything.
Yeah, well, and there needs also all the right wing talk show hosts and all the whole right wing blogosphere, everybody else out there that was promulgating this thing, they all need to set the record straight as well. And part of setting the record straight is pointing out that Carol Lamb was not fired for any reason other than politics. Period. That's what it boils down to. Phyllis in Palo Alto, California. Hey, Phyllis.
Oh, hi. Yes, I was so fascinated to hear this corporation stuff. I always thought it didn't make sense. I'm a poli-sci major from Berkeley, and I don't think we even learned that. Have you done anything with that information? You said you wrote a book.
Yes.
Have you been in touch with the ACLU or anyone to try and get something done on retraction?
Oh yeah, in the Nike Caskey versus Nike case, where you know that went to the Supreme Court year before last. It was interesting. The ACLU of Northern California and the ACLU of Southern California took opposite positions on it, one in defense of Nike and one in defense of Caskey. Mark Caskey was the guy who was saying, hey, wait a minute, you guys shouldn't have the right to lie to us. And Nike was saying, no, we have right of free speech and you can't limit it. And virtually every corporation in America, all the major ones, came out and wrote, amicus briefs, front of the court briefs on behalf of Nike. And it was really interesting to see the ACLU split on this, because part of the ACLU is of the opinion, well, if a corporation is a person, our job is to uphold First Amendment rights for persons. And
yeah.
Then the other part is saying, well, wait a minute, they're not a person. But then the other part of the ACLU says, well, but the Supreme Court precedent says that they are a person. And then the other part says, but there's no precedent. But in any case, yes, the book has gotten out. I've done a lot of speaking at law schools, Vermont Law School and others. There are a number of law schools that actually include it in the curriculum. And
but nobody does anything about it.
Well, the word is getting out. And there are and Phyllis, thank you for the call. There are anti-corporate personhood groups all across the United States now. And there have been a number of people since I wrote on equal protection who have come out with more fine-tuned and nuanced versions of the same thing and looks at corporate power and corporate rights. And the CELDEF, for example, the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund out of Pennsylvania, over 100 communities now in Pennsylvania have passed laws saying corporations don't have the rights of persons in our community. Thank you very much. And then you've got organizations like POCLAD, the Program on Corporations Law and Democracy, POCLAD.org, CELDEF.org, and POCLAD, doing some just great work in this area, promoting the idea that corporations should not have human rights and civil rights and all that sort of thing. So, I see the thing moving in the right direction, I'm optimistic about that. Chris, you got a quick one here? We've got about 30 seconds before we've got to take a break.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I agree with you and that corporations, there's absolutely no reason why they should have the rights of human beings. But also, just this whole internet monitoring thing, this is really creepy. I really hope that the people in the United States will clamp down on this as quickly as possible to make sure that we don't get this kind of stuff going to the extreme here in the United States. That would just be horrible.
Yeah. Well, we already do in the corporate environment. And we may actually even at the federal level. I mean, you just don't know. Chris, you're there. Pardon me. Chris, you're there in Cave Creek, Arizona. And how do you know that Alberto Gonzalez in Washington, D.C. isn't reading your email right now? Bush has already asserted that he has the right to. So, and that he has. Nancy Pelosi says to the White House, if I gave Syria the wrong message, prove it! This is great! Nancy Pelosi, take it on the White House. I'll give you the details right after this. 45 minutes past the hour.
The Tom.
Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
I love leaves in the wind, pictures of my friends, birds of the world, and squirrels. I love coffee in a cup, little fuzzy pups, old TV shows, and snow.
Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. It's Air America Radio on the Tom Hartman Program, 9.5 minutes before the hour. Nancy Pelosi says, okay, prove it, buddy. George Bush out there saying, well, she's sending mixed messages. Now, mixed signals. That was the phrase. Mixed signals. Right. So the State Department was asked today, is it true that George Bush, you know, that you know, when George Bush said that Nancy Pelosi is sending mixed signals to Syria by going there and talking with Assad, that, you know, it's complicating things for the State Department? Sean McCormick, State Department spokesman, quote, I don't think the trip necessarily complicates anything that we're doing. So but the right-wing scream machine is running full tilt boogie. Here you've got on Fox News, right-wing host Mark Williams, he says, Nancy Pelosi's in Syria lip-locking with the king of terrorists, and that we've been attacked by a 7th-century death cult known as Islam. Right. And then Suzanne Mulvaux yesterday on CNN, she's saying, why would anybody see Pelosi's trip as anything more than a political stunt, a publicity stunt, a big wet kiss to President al-Assad? So Pelosi, though, is fighting back. Pelosi spokesman Brendan Daly pointed out that Pelosi was briefed by State Department officials before her meetings with the foreign leaders, and the State Department officials also attended her meetings. This is from the Chicago Tribune blogs. So if Pelosi really committed foreign policy flubs of the first order, the State Department's in a position to confirm as much. The White House certainly received a readout of what exactly Pelosi and the foreign leaders said in their meetings. Significantly, the White House has not openly accused Pelosi of the foreign policy missteps the Post has accused her of. This is the Washington Post in today's slash and burn editorial. In an email follow-up, Daly wrote, the White House has not said that because, in fact, the Speaker did not get the message wrong. She included the necessary caveats and did not say or imply that this was a change in Israel's position. Very straightforward stuff. When are these guys going to stop? I mean, it's just amazing. Sharon in Camano Island, Washington, if I'm pronouncing
Tom.
That right, Sharon.
I think it's absolutely appropriate that Nancy Pelosi goes to Syria and goes to see other heads of state because after we impeach Bush and Cheney, she is going to be president and they should know her.
There you go. Sharon, from your lips to God's ears. Let's hope it's the case. Thank you so much. Great to hear from you. David in Manhattan. Hey, David.
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
I'm great, but I'll get better.
Listen, I've always thought this idea of corporations and personhood was kind of ridiculous going back to the Erie Canal in the 1800s. But if they want to take on personhood, they should be required to submit DNA, and we can clone them because they obviously have found the Philosopher's Stone, and they are immortal.
You can clone a corporation. That's the thing. I mean, you can spin off from a corporation another corporation easily. Corporations can live forever now. They've ended the limited lifespan of them. Corporations can... Here's another argument. We've ended slavery in the United States, which means a person can't own another person. Then why can a corporation own another corporation?
Well, basically, the Philosopher's Stone is the ability to live forever.
Yeah,
and so if
yeah.
we can get their DNA and their Social Security number, we can all live forever.
There you go. Okay, David, good point. And what we need to be working on. Mariana in New York City. Hey, Mariana.
Hi, how are you, Tom? Yeah, I was going to suggest assassinating them if they're people, but I guess that won't work since they can live forever. Well, I was going to say that in regard to the case that you described where the clerk entered that information into the record,
right.
It seems like that's some kind of fraud that was perpetrated, and it appears to me that this has continued and exists currently in our courts.
Yes.
Because I personally had an experience and I witnessed that there was a lot of creativity involved in trying to undermine the laws that were supposed to be upheld by the very same court officers that were supposed to uphold them.
No, you're absolutely right, Mariana, and this is nothing, and thank you very much for the call. This is nothing new. And in fact, there was another member of the Supreme Court by the name of Stephen J. Field who was on the court at the time, and we actually found the correspondence in the Library of Congress. Was it the Smithsonian? No, it was the Library of Congress. We found the correspondence between Stephen J. Field and the railroads, in which the railroads were telling him that if he would go along with this corporate personhood thing and promote it, and he was the Ninth Circuit Court judge. So back in those days, every member of the Supreme Court was also a circuit court judge. And they would ride the circuit for 6 months out of the year, and then 3 months out of the year, they'd all get together, the nine judges, and sit in the Supreme Court and be the Supreme Court. And so Stephen Field in the Ninth Circuit, which was California, was the guy who first said corporations have personhood rights. And so the railroads in California were saying to him, we will sponsor you for president. We will help you become president if you'll help us get personhood. And he was trying to corrupt the system. He was the one who kept throwing these tax cases into the Supreme Court because he was both the Ninth Circuit, he was the Ninth Circuit Court, and he was a member of the Supreme Court. And so the entire process was incredibly, mind-bogglingly corrupted by Field and others. And, you know, and as I said, also the clerk of the court, Davis, John Chandler Bancroft Davis, whose father, by the way, had previously been the governor of Massachusetts. Very wealthy and powerful family, you know, and very locked in with the railroad barons. Coming up tomorrow on the next Tom Hartman program on Air America Radio, Senator Bernie Sanders will be here. Brunch with Bernie. Bernie will be taking your calls as he does every Friday at noon Eastern Time. Mark Morano and I will be debating the issue of a carbon neutral life, truth or fiction. You decide because you're really the decider. And as always, the best of the rest of the news, that and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program, your radio support group for We the People on Air America Radio. And never forget, my friends, democracy begins with you, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it! See you tomorrow.
This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.